there is.
Has anyone joined the first session here? Okay. Well, welcome. It's a cool room. I like to think of it as the decompression space, in case of not going to the other one. So my talk is on psychology of UX and adoption. I'm a psychologist, not the couch type, but I studied psychology and interaction design. And when I was doing that, I learned a lot about models, like frameworks of how, like what drives people to adopt new technologies. And in preparing for this talk, like over the last weeks, I've been trying to apply that to our space to see like how does it translate all these frameworks. Yeah, so that's what I want to talk to you about. But first, I want to talk to you about porn and why that's interesting. That'll become a bit more clear, I hope so, later on. This magazine, Time Magazine, in 1992 declared hybrid porn specifically as one of the bigger inventions of the past millennium. Doesn't seem like a big deal. It was a big deal in agriculture, so it was a big deal for food around the world. But it was also a big deal for understanding what makes people adopt new technologies. Like side note, but what's interesting, this is 1992, a special fall edition. A lot of the content is sponsored by IBM. There's a lot of talk about like networked computers. There's no word on predictions of like the internet as we know it now and all the services that we use on it. Even though that like this was 1992, so we would expect that to be kind of ubiquitous knowledge already. So the story about porn, let me peek at some days here to check. Porn was invented, hybrid porn specifically, not porn. Hybrid porn was invented in 1928 by scientists of Iowa State University. And then years passed, it was released to farmers, and it had a lot of benefits to speak of. So the production rate could go up by 20%. Farmers could move to like mechanical ways of production because the way the corn grew had like changed like the size or the equal height of the stem, so it made it easier to cultivate. It was also much more resistant to drought. So there were a lot of functional benefits that would make farmers be like, "Yay, let's all like switch to hybrid corn," right? And then next to that, there was an alliance of farmers that also adopted this technology from the university and started pushing it and promoting it. So there was a lot going for this new type of cultivating corn. One of the downsides, because I mean obviously there were downsides, was that farmers would need to buy their seeds every year. So they needed to change something in their behavior compared to what they were accustomed to. And still, 13 years later, there was a team of sociologists that thought, oh wow, this corn business seems to be quite interesting. There's a lot of changes happening there. And so they wanted to figure out like why, what made some farmers decide to switch to hybrid corns, others not yet, so it was kind of a big deal in the state at the time. So they asked, like they sent out a survey to farmers in the state asking like why and when did you switch to this like new type of cultivation? And what they found was that within 5 years, 10% had switched to this new type of production. The 3 years after that, 40% more people or farmers switched to that new type of production. No Excel yet, but they plotted the data. And then they found this. Which if you've looked up any, like if you ever googled like technology adoption, you basically always find this S curve of like, okay, there's a like a first 10%, and then at some point it kind of grows a little bit more, and then there's this switching, like this critical point that we call like now there's critical mass, and this is what we all strive for, because at this critical mass we'll get there. That's when, like, mass adoption will happen. And then, this is a guy who kind of summarized that research and followed up by doing loads of research after in other fields to understand how does this translate. Is this S-curve something that occurs in every new technology that we introduce? His conclusion was yes. Like, he actually drew up that S-curve with some variations of different technologies. Like, interesting motivation for him to start looking into that was that he always saw his dad as a farmer kind of wait till the last minute when everyone was starting to use something new, and his, like, Uncle Eddie, another farmer, would already use something new. His dad would wait. And so he's also the guy that, like, kind of coined the terms late adopter, early adopter, after investigating that based on his family story. What he talks about is not necessarily adoption. Like, the whole concept of adoption is fairly new. What he talks about when he describes, like, studying new innovations is a diffusion of innovation, which, like, in his descriptions is slightly different. He actually says diffusion as a paradigm originates a bit more from anthropology, because anthropologists look at things from the perspective of humans, and they tend to take on that perspective to then blame a system or, like, credit a system when something something good or bad happens, but always from the perspective of users rather than a system. So Everett Rogers defines diffusion as a process by which an innovation, which is one point, is communicated, which is the second, over time. Time is a very critical element, according to him, and among members of a social system. I started to think that what are then the difference between that, like, type of diffusion and what we now see as adoption and what we, like, talk about so very often of reaching, like, crypto mass adoption. Some differences, if you look at, like, the different models out there, are that diffusion usually refers more to a society as a whole, whereas adoption is more related to the decision of one specific individual. Diffusion relates to technology, like an infrastructure, whereas adoption usually relates to a product or service, something built on top of that. In terms of what it does, like, functionally, diffusion relates to something being, like, supportive, not delivering the actual value instantly, whereas adoption is interactive, something that brings you value, you put some effort into it, it's interactive. And diffusion tends to take longer. So, and this is, like, study based on, like, a range of different technologies being introduced, that it takes about 20 to 30 years. Whereas adoption, if you think about, like, all the popular web services, they take between 5 and 10 years. Hybrid porn was a really rapid adoption at the time for a new technology, taking around 13 years, I believe. And then also there's just a very different stream of research into both, starting with Everett Rogers, but then there's this other guy, they're all men, who started to investigate adoption more closely. So next to porn, an interesting example is the computer mouse, which was is commonly credited as being invented in 1973. Actually, it had been around a little bit longer. And there's a really nice post, may have included the link, I'm not sure, by Bill Buxton, great guy. If you haven't heard of him, look him up. He has a wealth of information about how new technologies grow. He kind of describes the history of the computer mouse that I think is very analogous to how we might be looking at let's say Web 3 as a new technology. The mouse predator to be invented in 73 was actually 69, and then it still took years and years before it to actually reach household adoption. So there were commercially available products, especially by Xerox PARC, but before they reached household adoption was in 84, which is pretty much a long time after. The way Bill Buxton describes that difference is that there's actually, before that whole S-curve starts, there's a long nose of like the technology being developed, where you go kind of through like invention, which might happen at multiple points in time by different people. There's like a refinement and augmentation phase, and there's like the productization, where there's like actual stuff built on top of a technology. Like in my mind, we're kind of like in refinement and augmentation, like we're not really there yet, and let alone that we are at that like place where you can start to think of it as an S-curve. Why the analogy to a computer mouse to me is interesting is because the computer mouse needed an ecosystem, and this is what made it last or take quite long for the technology to be adopted. So it needed displays to use a computer mouse, it needed programs to effectively control a graphical user interface, and it needed all the manufacturing around it that took so long. Right. There is a link. So looking at these kind of pillars or variables, I would say, that Everett Rogers describes that are required for diffusion of innovation to happen is like the innovation itself. Like it needs to be new and interesting to people. Like it needs to actually add some value. It also needs communication channels. It needs a network of like merchants or like people that can sort of sell the technology, like the way the farmers had an alliance that would kind of vouch for the hybrid corn to be more effective than their average way of working. So it needs agents, is how it describes it. It also needs time. It needs time for people to go through their phases of decision making. So they need to like gather knowledge of how this stuff works. They need to have time to decide if it's something for them. They need confirmation that when they start using it, it actually works for them. And so there's all these stages that people need to go through first. And then there's a social system where it doesn't make much sense for me to have crypto if I can't use it anywhere else. So it definitely needs to have support from people in a closed environment. So that's, let's say, the diffusion of innovation. But when we then talk about adoption, which kind of grew later, what can we learn from that work that could apply to us as well? There is several models that nowadays are referred to as adoption models, but actually, like in the early days, they were called technology acceptance models, mostly because you didn't adopt technology, you accepted it because it was kind of enforced on or forced upon you by an employer. These are, I mean, in themselves, if you like models, they might be interesting. There's a bunch of them. What they have in common is basically these two factors. Something needs to be useful, or at least perceived as useful, and it needs to be easy to use. And especially the first one, it needs to be useful. At least from my perspective, or where I'm standing, I work for Status, which is very much infrastructure oriented. Useful is something that doesn't necessarily resonate. It's much easier for us to talk about the usability of the applications that we're developing at this point. So we could sort of add those to the model. And then there's obviously a lot of knowledge about UX, which is also relatively new. If you kind of look at the process of how like UX came to be, initially there was a bit more of a thing called human engineering when Bell Labs wanted to design the rotary phone. They were kind of struggling to decide, do the numbers go on the device itself or on the rotary? And they hired someone to test that and to like get input from people. And they wanted to design it such that it would fit humans, and they called it human engineering. Then the personal computer came, and the industry started talking about human-computer interaction. Which to me, that emphasis is interesting because it's talking about the computer, the system as a whole at that point in time. But if you look at kind of what happened to the industry after that, when web technology started to come up, like the emphasis switched more to human interface design, so it moved away from the system and kind of moved up to the surface of like, this is only what you interact with, and that's what we'll try and optimize. And then even later, even though like the term started to be used in 93, if you look at like the actual definitions, user experience happened. And that kind of only became popularized when services became more common on the internet. And this is so like looking at the definition of user experience, how that kind of shifted over time. There was this concept already, like context of use from these applications, right? Will something work in a particular factory with given timelines? That was kind of the extent of the usability. Then in 2010, there was a switch, and this is only 2010, it's not that long ago, that user experience was added. As in the person's perceptions and responses that result from the use and or anticipated use of the system, product, or service. These are standards. They're not the most fun read, but it's interesting to see how they change over time. By the way, it kind of looks like context of use is no longer important. It was just moved to another position in the document, so very much there still. And then another thing that happened in 2010 was that usability kind of got this side note added to it, where there was like another emphasis on specified users, the goals, the context of use referred to a particular combination of users, goals, and context of use for which usability is being considered. So again, this like reference to context. All right, so last year, and I'm sorry to say that this was like already last year, with some folks of Status, we went to South Korea for a field research trip where this context became incredibly clear. And also it became incredibly clear why we needed to be in the country to understand the context. What we found was, I mean, obviously there had been a high adoption rate of cryptocurrencies, but what we found was that it was especially connected to the housing market, the prices of the housing market, the social pressure of pressure for young people to buy a house, and then next to that, the investment regulation and how difficult it was for young people to find other means of investment than crypto. So this whole context kind of played into why people started to use cryptocurrency, not like just to make an extra buck or because it seemed interesting. There was a whole sphere or context around it. And so, looking at like another model, there's loads of these in psychology. This is also next to Don Norman, one of the fathers of UX, I would say. There's this continuous reoccurrence of there's something.
Sorry, guys.
That's my time. There's some like reoccurrence of something needs to be usable, but also needs to be useful in the first place, and that you see popping up over and over. So one thing that we can add, like, is the importance of context, because we see it coming back in all definitions. This is kind of like a side note, but a comment by this guy, Nielsen, that I find interesting is that over time we kind of switched from a you pay first, then you experience something, to you experience and then you pay, with the introduction of service models. It's an interesting thing to keep in mind because we're, in a way, reverting that. You pay first, you pay gas, and only then can you experience. All right, so from some of the studies that we did, there's one more factor that I would kind of add to that model of what are things that are important to at least think of or keep in mind or check to cover our bases if we want something to be adopted. What we found in Iran, where we thought privacy is going to be super important because we built a messaging application, turned out privacy was, yeah, it was important, but it wasn't super important. People had Telegram, it was blocked, and that only made it more trustworthy for some reason. What did come back over and over was this, it should be common among among everyone, and my friends should be on there too. So this social network. And then another one was from, I would say 3 months later, when we did a similar study in Japan. And in this study, we would ask people like about the current messaging applications they use, and we would ask to write either a breakup letter or a love letter, depending on like how they felt about their current application. And yeah, when kind of looking at like what does an application mean, we've got through this like, I don't know, strategy of like write a breakup letter, write a love letter, make it really apparent. We got to things like I'd lose so many contacts or I'd be so lonely as kind of explanations for the use of technology. And this, like, to me, would be reason to like emphasize or add this, sorry about the colors there, this concept of human connection, specifically because it's something that we really do not seem to take into account too much. As in any transaction I make on the blockchain so far does not allow me to like add a note or receiving any value does not allow me to say thank you, which is a pretty basic thing in any human interaction. And looking at other applications, that seems to be one of the defining aspects. So that's kind of like the list of factors that I would keep in mind, like either looking at like the wider picture of the technology, but also at the lower level, like do we give people time between switching, like trying out an application before they actually have to decide that they'll use it? Do we allow people to try something without backing up their seed trays? So how do we fit into this this concept of decision making? Do we have enough communication channels or agents in place? And there's a bunch of more. I kind of see it as a list of triggers, like things to think about. And that's all I have, except for the QR code, which I think you know a lot better what to do with that than I do. I was just asking about it there. I don't know. Hi everybody. There's a few more coming in. Thanks for being here. My name is Chris Sugg. I'm a UX UI designer at AirSwap. And today what I'd love to do is just tell you some stories about user research that we've conducted at AirSwap, and specifically some of the challenges of adapting kind of traditional UX research methods to these specific users within Ethereum. And I guess right off the bat, I also want to say, you know, this isn't really supposed to be a prescriptive talk per se, but more so just sharing a very lean product team's attempt to conduct meaningful research within the space and figure out how to do it well. So I hope we can all chat about it afterwards. Come up to me if you're doing stuff better than we are.
So off the bat, here's the agenda. We're going to do why user research, because we can't be in a place like this and not advocate for it at large. We're going to talk about two kind of buckets of user research, and then we're going to focus in on one side and talk about some specific methods that we have dealt with and adapted. All right, so why user research? The goal here is not just to build good products, but it's to build the right product. And when I say the right product, I mean a product that is for the end user. And I think this quote by IBM puts it well. User research focuses on understanding user expectations, behaviors, and needs and motivations through methodical investigative approaches. Insights are then used to ensure that all product design decisions do benefit the user. And I think this is something for this space that we need to remember. The products we're building are for the user. They're not for us as the developers, the designers. They're for the user in the end, and so let's work to get to that end. So now let's talk about two kinds of user research. If you're a designer or a researcher, this may be a 101 kind of situation, but we're going to go through it anyway. We've got quantitative and qualitative. So when we're talking about quantitative research, this is evaluative research. So these findings will come out in measurable data, a numerical format. Some examples of this could be heat mapping. So how many times is a user clicking on a button? How many times are they missing a field? Eye tracking, A/B testing, etc. We're going to be talking about qualitative today, which is more exploratory. It sometimes gets a bad rap as sort of the softer of the research sciences, but the whole point of qualitative research is to observe behaviors and attitudes. The findings are non-numerical. Some examples here would be interviews, field studies, and focus groups. This is the more sort of personal research. It's human connection and understanding sort of core motivations of people as opposed to just numbers. So just to give you a little bit of a snapshot, the point here is not to say that one of these research sides is better than the other, but it's about using them together to get the best research you can get. So at AirSwap, we use a combination of a ton of tools, and this is just a few. So on the quantitative side, we use a couple products. We use Hotjar and Mixpanel. This is where we do our heat maps, recordings. We track our conversion funnels, KPIs, daily active users, etc. These are the ones that we hear a lot about. So qualitative research on the other side, we have canny feature requests, so our users can freeform ask us for features, Telegram and Discord feedback channels, so again, sort of a freeform avenue for our users to talk to us. And then the three that we're going to kind of live in for the rest of our time together are surveys, field studies, and user interviews. So qualitative research, we need it, Ethereum needs it, and the reason we need it is this kind of research is what takes us out of our contexts and shows us what our users really need. So it takes us out of being developers, industry insiders, designers that love Ethereum, and puts us in the spot of our users to understand what they really need for products. But qualitative research is hard in Ethereum, and we're going to talk about why. And I think the crux of the thing is basically this. Our users go by wallet addresses and not names. So what I mean by this, you can imagine on a traditional platform, if I'm signing up for Pinterest, I'm signing up with my name, my email address, probably my date of birth if I'm thinking about doing that. I may have even checked subscribe to email list while I did that, and then on top of it, maybe they have a social media presence that I'm following with an identity attached to it. So in normal Web 2, consumer web, there is identity that is fundamentally connected to the product. So when you're looking at doing recruitment or conducting research, there are pretty easy avenues to get to those people, to find them, to know who's using it. For us, on the other hand, we have wallet addresses. And for our users, this is one of the biggest value propositions of the entire thing. Their anonymity, their security is huge, and we care about that. But how do we conduct research when that's the case? And it goes into everything. Who even are our users? Where can we find them? And then if we can figure out who they are, if we can figure out where to find them, how can we actually get to know them? Again, in this true sort of human way, get to know their needs. So We're going to start with who are our users, and we're going to talk about UX surveys. So when we're talking about sort of fundamental UX surveys in traditional world, the goal of a survey is to gather both quantitative and qualitative insights from a lot of users at once. So this is a research method that doesn't cost a lot. You can send it out to a huge distribution channel, subscription list. You can send it to a company and they can do it for you. You can then extract trends and understand all kinds of things from a lot of people. The second way this is used would be like a screener survey for recruiting users for future research. So for us, this piece was really interesting. We were interested in the first, of course, but we want to recruit users. We want to find these people. I mean, I personally wanted to bring them into the office. We'll talk about that later. But so here's what we found. The distribution piece was hard. And we've done, these are just two snapshots of a couple surveys, but we've done a ton. So when we were first doing survey, we were like, okay, let's get it to a ton of people. And so we thought maybe Craigslist, like maybe we could put together a survey that would really weed out the real crypto people, the real Ethereum people. And we got a fair number of responses. We got like 80 responses, and we actually did bring 3 people into the office, which was a total shit show, and talk to me after if you want to hear about it. And it was interesting. They did give us insights, but what we realized is that it wasn't quite spot on enough, that this distribution channel, it wasn't quite representative of the kinds of people that were using our products. They needed to be more savvy. So then we were like, all right, this was too broad, let's make it smaller, let's not expect as many respondents, but let's expect some quality. So then we went to Telegram and Reddit, we distributed there. You can see for this survey we had 11 responses, which, you know, that's not a ton. But the thing with these responses is that they were excellent. Super high quality responses. We had people responding in paragraphs and paragraphs about their experiences. They were willing to answer all of the questions, and it was great. But as far as recruiting them for future research, they were not in. Of those 11 respondents, 3 people responded with their Telegram handles, none of which responded when I reached out to them. So we realized that our users are absolutely willing to give rich responses to these open-ended questions, as well as closed-ended questions in survey form, but they still want to remain anonymous. And so here, we were like, all right, we got something from it. So there you go. We're not going to get those things from them. At least not right now. Okay, so where are our users? Let's talk about adapting UX field studies for a second. The goal of field studies is to observe users in their natural environment and to situate oneself as the researcher in user-specific contexts. So coming into the Ethereum ecosystem, I come from working just, you know, with internet stuff and consumer tech. And when I think of field studies, I think of like doing a field study for REI, going into an REI store for 4 hours and watching consumers look at the sunglasses, look at sweaters. This is not like that. There's nowhere I can go to find Ethereum users to watch them do their daily things, but just because we can't do it in person does not mean that we can't see what people are doing. So this is an example of what I'm going to call a field study. This is a screenshot from Telegram. We were building a product for OTC traders. And so this is a trading chat room. And what's really interesting here, there's a little bit of gibberish. WTS, hashtag Axel, 1900, 0.1 ETH, translates to want to sell 1900 Axel at price 0.1 ETH. So what's interesting here, we were trying to figure out how to create a really intuitive order builder for OTC trades. So the main inputs on this thing are selecting a token and amount to send, and then selecting a token and amount to receive. But what was so interesting here is that the syntax that these traders are using is not sell 1900 Axel and receive 190 ETH, which was represented in a lot of the products that were already on the market. And so what we got to do is implement a price field, which for us was a huge differentiator from what was already out there. And we heard from our traders very actively that this really helps their workflow. that they're thinking about what they're going to send and a price, not just what they're sending and receiving. So this is one example of how we sort of adapted field studies and applied it. So now let's talk about UX interviews. We want to get to know them. And traditionally, UX interviews are all about an informal setting to really get to know someone, to get beneath what they think they want, and to get at what they really want. So you're trying to uncover user motivations, feelings, needs, and pain points, and it's very personal. It's about putting a face to the person using it. Now, this is hard. Like I said, we had some people come in, but again, they weren't quite representative of the users that we really wanted to be building for. And there are a few challenges with the users that we're really trying to build for, which is that they are global, they're everywhere, they're not going to come into our New York office, and they don't exactly want their face to be seen. So while we may not be able to see them, we can work to create analogous research environments over chat and through forums. So what I did was cold message people on Telegram and said, "Hi, I'm Chris. I'd love to just talk to you about OTC." And a number of people were incredibly generous and really did talk to me. And, you know, I don't have their name, but I was still able to get to a point where I started to understand who they were and what they needed. Some other ways that we have approached this, so that's sort of the individual connection piece. We actively foster community around our products. And so we do phased product releases. On our most recent one, we start with a closed beta, and this is paired with a Telegram or Discord channel that we've had people sign up for, who then have conversation, give us active feedback. We implement that feedback. We do a public beta. We invite people into another channel. And so just creating a space where we can still get this informal sort of human feedback on the things that we're doing. So in the end, you know, we may not have a name, and I think that what I have learned is that we don't necessarily need a name, because we can still get to know our users through creatively thinking about the kinds of ways that they are interacting with the world and the way that they're interacting with one another. So that's pretty much it. But for those of you in the room, I don't know, is anyone like a UX researcher or has conducted UX research? Okay. Yeah, tell me what you do later. Because, no, it's tough. It's tough. But it's good. Thank you.
That's about the shit show.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, go ahead. Oh, you want to hear about the shit show? Yeah, so we had these interviews. The first guy came, and I was actually out on the sidewalk having a cigarette, and he came up to me, and he was clearly drunk, like actually drunk. And I was like, oh, geez. And I was like running away, and he was like, oh, is this AirSwap? And I was like, oh, yeah, this is AirSwap. And he was like, oh, I'm here for the user interviews. And I was like, come on down. So that was the first guy. Another guy was probably a dark web criminal. And the third guy was like absolutely useless. Like, I think he just wanted the gift card. I mean, there were insights to be had as far as just, you know, the consumer side. These were definitely kind of like edge case people that were not exactly our people. So we were able to get something from it. But yeah, that was that. Yeah. Oh, well, okay. Yes.
Google Analytics.
Yes. Well,
if you, I'm asking if you use it. Like, I tried it with my team, and they, like, some of them objected it. So we ended up not using it.
Okay.
And I wonder what you are doing.
I don't think we're using Google Analytics. Oh, we are.
We use it now, but it's private, so we're just.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that the gift cards. So I was wondering about like incentives.
Yeah.
The other thing is like, you know, some of this stuff is new to me, but you know, like people ring these like unicorn badges to identify that they're here. So like, you try to do anything creative around like badges and wallets to like recruit people. And,
well, we did think about these kind of things. And we used a gift card for this particular session.
Yeah.
And I think that was what got people in the door. But at the end of the day, like, the people that we want to be talking about, we don't, or talking to, rather, I don't think that necessarily luring them into the door are the people that we're trying to talk to. Like, you know, what we found on the surveys is, like, these people want to give feedback. Yeah. We all want to contribute to making it better. It's just a matter of figuring out how to connect to them and find them.
So anybody doing, like, industry-wide studies? Is there any, like...
Somebody must be.
You're doing a way too.
Was that? You're doing what?
There are. See, yeah, the Rimble team is doing on UX pattern in general, the consensus Rimble team. It's a design system. We've done a bunch of those, and we are doing now on the industry on layer two. There's a talk here tomorrow on that layer two design pattern.
How are you connecting?
With users?
Yeah, no, not just with users, but like you know, a lot of product people are looking for to aggregate and to understand what the trends are. So like, how do we, you know, obviously like these individual companies have relatively small budgets, but in aggregate, you know, we need like deep research from like thousands of users.
Yeah, it's
I don't
know. It's her session. If you want, we can.
Talk. No, it's fine.
Like, is this the
design talk?
This,
okay.
This
oh,
is the best.
Okay.
Yeah. This is the room for the talk, yes.
Yeah. So in terms of technology, are you able to identify your users and contact them directly or not?
So I think that what we found is, you know, Telegram handles are sometimes the extent of the identification, but then there are also, of course, those users that we do have actual relationships with, mm-hmm. that we know a name of, or at least a first name.
Yeah.
But I think that in my head, most of them are their Telegram handles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, it would be interesting to see, like, if you have users that use your platform a lot, to start with interviewing those instead of some random drunk dude who wants to start.
Yeah. And of course, we've done that. I think that the idea, because I think this is always kind of a tension here, is like, do we just try to build for the people that are already using it, or are we trying to get, you know, at least a degree further towards a new user, or, you know, so I think that represents also that goal, so, yeah.
And can you talk a bit about if any learnings came from the quantitative side? Did you learn something interesting?
Just about the users in general?
Yeah, or I don't know, you design something and you discover that something wasn't working somehow. I don't know, just if any.
I think, what was fun was talking to some of our users and actually sending them designs. So there are a few that we're pretty close with now that I've actually sent like active prototypes to, and they have like mocked them up and added comments. And you know, we take it with a grain of salt, they're not designers, but it's been fun to see them sort of actively engaged with what we're doing. And
yeah. From Mixpanel and Mondjaro, I meant from that, any...
Oh, the quantitative side.
Yes, sorry.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think those, and again, it being evaluative, it's showed us, like, for example, on our decks, our instant experience, like, we noticed that people were missing, they were clicking something that wasn't supposed to be clicked, and they were missing the thing that was supposed to be clicked. And it's that kind of thing that, you know, you have to see that really improves it, so, yeah.
Is there resistance to, like, things like segment and tracking data? Like, do people freak out?
I don't know if they freak out, but I think that in general we can say, like, ideologically in this space, people don't want their data to be tracked or held. But I'm not saying from personal experience, I've come up against someone, you know, up in arms about.
Maybe I can add something to that.
Yeah.
So, not my previous company, but a company I worked before, we had a lot of users and a lot of data. And we saw a drop of basically from 100 to 70% of people actually blocking things like segment with privacy badgers. So that meant that like we were missing like a lot of traffic because of that. And then on top of that, because we're European, we had the GDPR,
yeah.
Which meant that we saw another drop of 40%. So in the end, if you looked at all the traffic, we were really worried that like our traffic was actually going down because over the time span of a year it was dropped like by almost 50%.
Yeah.
But then actually looking at the profit and other things, that was pretty good. So we saw this big mismatch between what our data was telling us,
yeah.
And then what the reality was happening on our platform. So then we went back to server side tracking and we wrote our own plugins to basically circumvent like a lot of the tracking. That was blocked, so and then we made a combination of those to actually see okay, what is actually going on so that we can make better decisions again? Because at first it was really scary to see all these drops. Was these drops were only from people blocking it or not allowing us to crack drops? So yeah, so I think that was for us a very good insight to realize that, okay, you think differently. So that's one, and then the other thing is that from a statistical point of view, it's very difficult if you have like a small set of data to actually make something that you can draw conclusions from. And I see a lot of smaller startups actually really trying to use Google Analytics and things like this, which is really not that useful unless you have like really a lot of traffic. So yeah. So then things like Hotjar, actually recording sessions and looking into this, that's very useful, but also realize that a platform like Hotjar is also doing the same. So it's not recording every session, but it's trying to like feel like, okay, this is something significant, and then they'll look at you.
Oh.